the top Iranian general says measures taken against Israel by resistance forces will bring the regime to its senses. Iran launches the final phase of the clinical trial of its first indigenously developed coronavirus vaccine. The Indian Prime Minister says that the surge in COVID cases has shaken the nation. India is experiencing the fourth straight day of record peaks. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, the chief of the general staff of the Iranian armed forces is saying that anti-Israel measures recently taken by resistance forces and similar future steps will bring the Tel Aviv regime to its senses. Major General Mohammad Bagheri says that Israel wrongly thinks that it will get no response to its continued mischievous acts against Syria and others, including those operations at sea. The general did not specify any particular group, but pledged that the resistance front will surely give the regime a strong response. The general also stressed that Israel will not be in peace if it continues its mischief against Iran. Now, those comments came after a Syrian missile hit near a nuclear power plant in the Israeli city of Damanhour. On that note, I'll be joined by a couple of guests to discuss this a bit further. We'll have Barak Grossman, international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia, and also Faraz Ali, political commentator, who is joining us out of Malmo, Sweden. Now, welcome to the special coverage, gentlemen. Now, let's go to Bali, Indonesia. Barry, let's have your assessments of these latest developments by the Tel Aviv regime and the way that Iran has decided to give a response.
Well, look, in the grand scheme of things, I think the comments made by the chief of staff are very measured. Remember, we're talking about an entity here that is Israel, which is occupying the land of two different nations, Palestine and Syria, which has essentially openly admitted having a state-sanctioned assassination program, is a belligerent which routinely flies sorties firing missiles almost randomly at Syrian targets, has essentially declared itself to be at war with Iran, has engaged in acts of espionage and cyber warfare targeting nuclear facilities, and a whole raft of other matters which individually, let alone collectively, can be considered acts. So the comments, I think, are perfectly reasonable, and I think they speak for themselves. Obviously, the resistance will continue to take the fight to the occupation as they see fit, bearing in mind that the occupation itself is also in a continuing state of warfare with Syria, with the resistance, with Hezbollah, with Iran, and other entities. So this is perfectly reasonable.
Now let's turn to Sweden. We also have Faraz Ali there. Faraz, in terms of accountability, tell us about that and what could anyone do if any international organization, international community cares about this, and also in terms of regional stability. Some people are, you know, the West, especially the spirited by Washington, they're always blaming countries like Iran for being a destabilizing force in the region. Now, who's bringing instability to this region?
It's very obvious, as your honorable guest from Bali said, that Israel is the one who creates problem in the region. The example he gave is continuously Israeli attacks on Syrian targets since 2011 without any reaction from the international community. The Syrian government has focused on fighting the terrorists, and Israel, with their hitting and attacking goals inside Syria, has actually helped the terrorists in Syria. So it's actually on time that someone puts a limit for the Israeli occupation forces and their continuously attacks on sovereign countries. And the problem with Israel is that if no one puts a pressure on them or limits for them, they'll exceed their attacks and take further measures. But with this, as the general said, General Bakri, when they are hitting back the resistance front, when they're hitting back at Israeli goals, they're putting a limit to Israeli attacks because they will focus on their domestic security. We're not to forget that in the end of the day, the domestic security of Israel, the Israeli occupation, is their Achilles heel. And we saw that the two last days when over 40 rockets were fired from Gaza to Israel, the line of argument for the security cabinet, which Netanyahu led, was that we want to preserve the calm.
Okay. Now, Barry, we have Washington engaged in discussions with Iran and the European sides, you know, the P4 plus four countries, as they're called, the Iran nuclear deal thing. And then at the same time, we have Israel doing that sabotage act at Iran's Natanz facility. Is it possible for Israel to do this without the knowledge of the United States?
Well, I think it's possible. I guess the question is, would they want to? Is there any reason why they would do it without U.S. knowledge? Certainly, there would be a measure of need to know. But frankly, I've come to think of Israel and the United States as one, Israel being pretty much the 51st state, if you like. Indeed, mm-hmm. The only reason they're not probably is they'd be limited to having two senators instead of essentially controlling the U.S. government if they joined the United States. But to be perfectly clear, there's really no room for any kind of sensible dispute about the right of Syria and is fighting in Syria against legitimate targets to take the fight to Israel as a result of Israel repeatedly engaging in acts of war against them. As your other guest said, Israel is the entity in the region that decades introduced political instability and brought grief to millions of people in the region, and it's time for a response. I don't think there's really a lot of room to take anything said by the United States seriously, or certainly nothing relating to these plans for hopefully further negotiation. General Salami spoke very perfectly about that. The Iranian position is very clear. The Americans withdrew and broke the agreement. Let them guarantee their full compliance, and Iran will honor its commitment. But until then, nothing really to discuss or negotiate. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the dramas at Damone the other day, I, for one, am less than convinced that that wasn't completely orchestrated by the Israelis, whatever else might have happened in the lead up to it. There was certainly some kind of a missile explosion claimed by the Israelis to be a controlled demolition of old ordinances. But somehow, I think they're trying to paint it in a nicer light than they would care to admit. Mm-hmm. The resistance has decided it's time to start taking measured action against an enemy which continues to assassinate and murder members of the occupation, civilians in Syria, and is out to create a major conflict in the region with Iran.
Okay. And for us, remember the other day, we had the Israeli Iron Dome that proved not to be so effective because we had the missile fired from Syria to land close to the Dimona Air Base. And then we have Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that Israel is ready for all scenarios when you see this vulnerability of the so-called Iron Dome.
Well, I think the Israeli leaders are merely making cheap talks for their public. You have to remember that besides the security problems that Israel is facing when it's confronting the resistance front, they even have political problems, internal troubles inside Israel. Israel is maybe facing their fifth elections since 2019. So, and Netanyahu has also problems with court issue against him for corruption, as many of his predecessors. So that's the talking they do for their internal public. But I don't think even the Israeli civilians, Israeli settlers are so naive that they think they trust someone like Netanyahu or their own leaders. As we've seen before, if we go back to the 33-day war on Lebanon, an Israeli newspaper back then, I don't remember the name, but they made an opinion poll inside Israel about who they believed. The Prime Minister of Israel was Olmert at that time, or said Hassan Nasrallah. And I think it was over 70% of the Israelis who participated in the poll that stated that they believe on Nasrallah more than on their own leaders. So what Netanyahu are doing is cheap talk, and the Israelis are seeing the facts on ground. The accusation that the Israeli leaders came with, I mean, I'm not a military expert, but that an anti-aircraft missiles go so wrong and directs from Damascus towards Dimona, approximately 300 kilometers far away from Damascus direction, that's not even something that children will believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for your contribution and insights. Barrett Grossman, international lawyer in Bali, Indonesia, and Faraz Ali, political commentator from Malmo, Sweden, joined us with their comments and insights. Now, moving on, the Iranian army has unveiled a series of new military achievements, including advanced drone systems. Taha and Tiam are the most important systems to improve the efficiency of the local drones. A correspondent, Humayun Abadi, has attended that ceremony.
Iranian Army's ground force unveiled several new achievements developed by the local experts. In a ceremony in Tehran and in the presence of high-ranking officials, seven new achievements were put on show. Portable radar alarms, portable laser alarms, micro-turbojet engine, Tiam 1400 surveillance system, artificial intelligence-based flight system, Taha 1400 interception system, and upgraded ground-based jamming systems were the new breakthroughs showcased in this event.
What we are producing is based on the battlefield needs. The systems we are unveiling today can meet our military needs if any threat would come up. The Islamic Republic is now on the verge of self-sufficiency in building drones, and what is important for us now is the equipment mounted on the drones to improve their efficiency. Taha and Tiam systems will increase the operational range of our drones.
All these new military stuff have been developed by the Research and Self-Sufficiency Organization of the Army. The new systems make the identification, surveillance, and destruction of aerial and ground targets easier.
Today, the drones are a new component of armed conflicts. The ground force of Iran's army has realized that the future threats are totally different from the past ones. Therefore, it has built UAVs, which can fly at high altitudes and can carry a great amount of ammo.
Tiam 1400 has the ability to detect various types of air surveillance radar signals and transmit the received signals to disrupt them. Taha 1400 is another system that uses antennas to cover a wide area of operation and maintains the flight safety of various drones in the enemy areas.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are solely for defense purposes, and that the Islamic Republic will never negotiate over its defense capabilities. Humayun Abadi, Tehran.
The Iranian foreign minister has again condemned what he calls Washington's medical terrorism against the Iranian people. Mohammad Javad Zarif says that COVID patients in Iran are suffering due to Washington's sanctions on drugs and medical equipment. He said that the Palestinians are also having a hard time dealing with the pandemic, while the U.S. has a vaccine surplus. This, he added, is due to Washington's malice toward the Palestinians. Zarif also called for an international inoculation program to tackle the pandemic. Now, this is while Iran has launched the final phase of clinical trial of a local COVID-19 vaccine. The Jab dubbed Coviran Barakat as the first vaccine indigenously developed by Iranian experts. Dr. Amini Mohra is a member of Iran's coronavirus task force, and Hussein Ali Chahriari, the head of Iran's Parliamentary Health Commission, also took part in the human trial. Mohra said that the vaccine is estimated to have between 70 and 90% efficiency even against a UK variant of the virus.
On UK variant, yes, because we have examined that and it was fully effective on UK variant, fortunately. But the Indian variant, we don't have the virus yet, but as soon as we get the virus, we will do the examination of that. But on UK variant, yes, it is effective.
Some 20,000 people have volunteered to receive the shot in the third stage. Authorities have predicted Iran will be able to produce 25 million doses of Coviran by the end of summer. Iran is working on 8 COVID vaccines to immunize the population against the respiratory disease. The country is also importing foreign vaccines under the COVAX mechanism of World Health Organization. India has set a global record for daily COVID infections for a fourth straight day, registering 350,000 new cases. Total cases in the world's second most populous nation is inching closer to 17 million. It also set a new record of deaths, nearly 2,800 fatalities, and that pushes the total to 192,000. Meantime, the capital, New Delhi, has extended the lockdown measures by another week. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has urged all citizens to take COVID vaccines and exercise caution, warning that a storm of infections has shaken India. Officials blame the spike on public reluctance to social distancing and other health protocols. Infections have overwhelmed hospitals in major cities, with many facing shortages of oxygen supplies and beds. The COVID pandemic also continues to take its toll on Europe. Several countries on the continent are reporting a surge in both infections and fatalities. Germany had 120 new deaths, bringing the fatalities to more than 81,000. There were also 18,700 infections, pushing the case load to around 3.3 million. Italy reported 322 deaths and some 14,000 new infections. The country has registered 119,000 fatalities and 4 million cases. Meanwhile, the UK posted 32 new deaths and more than 2,000 cases in the span of a day. Britain is among the hardest hit nations in Europe, despite mass vaccination. Now look at Latin America. Brazilian officials reporting 71,000 new confirmed COVID cases, raising the tally to 14.2 million. The country also recorded 3,000 new deaths as April became the deadliest month there since the pandemic began. Brazil's total fatalities now standing at over 386,000. Meantime, COVID cases in the United States have surpassed the 32 million mark. The virus has also claimed more than 571,000 lives in the U.S., the world's worst hit country by the pandemic. That's a wrap for this news broadcast.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a pit permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size of shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, these are children.
Exactly.
They're not harmless, so.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing, and he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun, and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. and therefore we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken, and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
I think in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment could be used in active shootings, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest, and I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they are not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil. And just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to our program for a better life with me, Javed Akbari. Today we are going to discuss an important saying from the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. In fact, this saying of the Imam is Hikmah number 6 of Nahj al-Balagha. The commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, صدر العاقل صندوق سره والبشاشة حبالة المودة والاحتمال قبر العيوب. Now, this this saying of the Imam deals with disclosing one's secrets, sadrul aqili sunduq sirri, meaning that the bosom of the wise is the safe of his secrets. The chest of a wise person is the safe of his secrets. And of course, walbashashatu hibalatul mawadda, cheerfulness is the bond of friendship. And then walihtimalu qabrul uyub, effective forbearance is the grave of shortcomings. Of course, this maxim is very short and it needs explanation, and we are going to explain what actually it means. For example, the bosom or the chest of a wise person is the safe of his secrets. Obviously, everybody has secrets, and there's no one in this world who doesn't have one. Secrets are a part and a parcel of everybody's life. They are a part and parcel of everybody's life. They are a part and parcel of your life as well. So, imagine the example of a box. Things which are important are kept in a box, or they are kept in a safe. Okay. If you want to protect something, you put them in a box in order to keep them safe. Now, the secrets are always kept in the chest. You know, everybody has secrets. Now, if you open your chest to other people and disclose your secrets, then you are going to let the cat out of the bag. Okay. You are going to reveal your secrets to other people. You are going to endanger yourselves, endanger those who are associated with you. And that's why it is very important for every individual to keep his secrets to himself and not to disclose them to anyone. Okay? For example, you have secrets and you want to get married in the future. So, don't reveal your secrets to anyone, even your future spouse, okay? If you are a woman and you have done something wrong in the past, do not disclose your secrets to anyone. Even if you are going to talk to your husband, even if that person to whom you want to disclose your secrets is your future husband, do not disclose them at all, because it's going to have some impact on your husband's treatment. It's going to have some negative impact. For example, your husband will definitely lose his confidence and his trust in you. So, the secrets that you are going to reveal to that person, maybe to your husband, will haunt him continuously and constantly, and therefore his behavior will change as a result of knowing what you have done in the past or what you have committed in the past, okay? No matter whoever that person is, so you should not and you must not disclose any of your secrets to anyone. Despite its name, secret is a title, a name given to things which you hide from other people. Despite its name, most secrets unfortunately do not remain secrets at all. And we know, of course, in our daily life, we see and we come across people who want to take other people by surprise, and they reveal something which lead to some kind of remorse, to some kind of regret at the end.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to our ourselves, we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We often tell our best friends our secrets, but is friendship enough? Is it enough? Is it an enough reason to disclose our secrets to them? Finding people who can be trusted can be very difficult in modern time especially. And it takes a huge amount of trust and respect for us to have the courage to tell them our most precious secrets. And of course, there is no doubt that there are different types of secrets, and there are different types of secret keepers, of course. Some people tell your secrets to others because they think the other party has a right to know. Some will share your secrets to share the load, especially if the secret is bothersome, you know. They keep, you know, they feel some kind of, you know, pressure to tell something, to disclose your secrets to other people. And they cannot stop thinking about it. Some secrets are actually revealed to help the person if urgent and if needed, you know, if they are urgent, if needed. So these are different types of secrets. Then on the other side, there are people who are naturally blabbermouth. You know, they want to disclose your secrets and they cannot help disclosing, you know. They cannot help keeping your secrets to themselves. So these are people who actually cannot stop talking. They are poor secret keepers. There is no doubt about it. There are some people, and there are also those who find joy in spreading the secrets of others. I've personally come across people who actually enjoy disclosing someone else's secrets, okay, sharing your secrets or the secrets of other people with their friends. And these are gossip makers, backstabbers, you know. They are people who stab you from behind. They are the poorest kind of secret keepers. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says that Sadrul Aqili Sunduqu Sirri, the chest of a wise person is the safe of his secrets, and one should not disclose in and open his chest and disclose and divulge his secrets to anyone. And then the saying, the maxim actually continues, Wal Bashashatu Hibalatul Mawadda. This part of the saying or the maxim of is also important. You know, bashasha means cheerfulness. Now, cheerfulness is the bond of friendship. It means that if you are continue to be cheerful, so you actually through cheerfulness, through smiling, through being very cheerful, you can attract people. So it is a kind of catching other people, putting them in the trap of friendship. And of course, it's only through smiling, through being cheerful, that you can attract other people. And then, well, ihtimalu qabr al-uyub, then there is this part of the saying, which unfortunately cannot be explained in this episode because we have already run out of time. Inshallah, let's put it for the next episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need, so all I need, so all I need, all I need. Oh, 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 oh.
Cause your love is all I need to be all I need. your love is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.